You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is part 3 of 7 in that series for 2009. Rick Britton introduces today's guest speaker.
Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming, and it's great to see so many folks on a rainy evening. I don't know about y'all, but I missed the memo saying that we'd all move to Seattle. Is this on? Just wanted to tell you really quickly, there's a new book out. If you're a military historian, if you're really into the technical military stuff, and I have a feeling that a lot of y'all are because you're here tonight, it's by John C. McManus, American Courage, American Carnage. It's a chronicle of the whole history of the 7th United States Infantry. And the reason I'm showing you this is it happens to have the largest collection of my map work in any one book. 20 of my maps are in this book. So it's... They kind of get lost, though, because it's 600 pages, and I filled 20, that's all. But anyway, I've got the copy back there to show you. He's a great writer. He's a really good guy. Please do come with us on the trip next week. I didn't do a very good write-up about the battlefield. I'm really excited about the trip a week from today on the 24th, because we're going on a trail walk that has just recently been opened by the Museum of the Shenandoah. We're going on to Rose Hill, which is actually where the majority of the fighting was done. And we're going to see what remains of that famous stone wall that Jackson's men were behind, not the stone wall from First Manassas, but the stone wall from First Kernstown, and where the majority of the fighting was, and we'll be some of the first folks out there because it hasn't been opened very long. And then we're going to eat at a buffet place outside of Winchester, and we're going to go into Winchester, which is a charming little town if you don't know it, and we're going to go to the Stonewall Jackson Headquarters Museum, which is absolutely stunning. I was there a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago, and I was amazed at how many original items they have there. It really is amazing. Then we're going to go down to the Pedestrian Mall, and they do have an ice cream shop, by the way, on the Pedestrian Mall. That's important. That's important. I know, I've learned from y'all that that's very important. And we're going to see a Civil War museum that's in the old courthouse, and it's absolutely beautiful, right on the Pedestrian Mall, and it's a really lovely setting, so please do join us. But that's not why we're here. We're here to hear this gentleman who's so patiently sitting right over here waiting for me to stop flapping my gums. This gentleman is a good friend of the Senior Center. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him for a number of years and have reenacted on his park, wow, a lot of times, 20, 25 times. He's the director of the Newmarket Battlefield Park. If you remember, he gave us a great talk last year. He's a great speaker. He's a great guy. Please join me in welcoming Scott Harris.
Thank you. And for those of you who remember my talk last year, I'm glad to be here on time without benefit of navigational improvisation, as I had to deal with, so it's very much a pleasure to be back. I will also commend to your attention, when you're on the Loudoun Street Mall in Winchester, if the buffet didn't quite do it for you, check out the Snow White Grill, where you can get a bag of greasy hamburgers about this big, just like if you went to White Castle, and it's like Garrison Keillor says, it's a bag that the grease leaks through, so it's, you know it's good, and I would heartily recommend that. It is a pleasure to be back with you all tonight and to be able to talk a bit about a battle that's not my day job. As Rick said, I'm the director of the Newmarket Battlefield State Historical Park, which was the topic of my discussion last year. How many folks were here for last year's talk? Oh, okay, not the whole audience. So good. Well, I can come back maybe in a couple of years and do the other one for you. Being at the Newmarket Battlefield, we obviously are focused on principally that battle, which was noteworthy for the Corps of Cadets at VMI coming out with the rest of the Confederate Army in 1864 and fighting what was really the first major battle of the year in that year of 1864, and really one of the last Confederate victories in the Shenandoah Valley. What we'll spend a little time looking at tonight is another time, another place, another battle, and a very different situation, both in the Shenandoah Valley, much earlier in the Civil War, and different situation given who was involved with this fight and some of the things that were going to come about as a result of what happened. I'm going to pause just for a moment to make sure that the level is working on my podcasting. Everything's good there? Okay, very good. Thank you. First Battle of Kernstown, which was fought on March 23rd, 1862, might best be described as a contradiction in terms. It is remembered as a tactical defeat for the otherwise successful Stonewall Jackson, but it was a strategic victory in the reaction that it provoked from the Union side. Faulty intelligence and dysfunctional communications contributed greatly to Jackson's actions before and during the battle, but rather than inspiring him to be more open with his subordinates, Kernstown caused Jackson to keep his own counsel from this point forward, and often this would be to the consternation of those that were under his command. Something Jackson was very good at provoking in lots of people, including those under his command. The hamlet that would be known as Kernstown was originally called Hogue's Ordinary. Ordinary, of course, being an 18th century and perhaps older term for a tavern. Later, the enclave would be called Opeckin, referring to the creek that's flowing in that area. And later, Carnesville. I've not really been able to figure out where the Carnesville came from, but the folks at the Handley Library helped me confirm that that was one of the several early names for this little enclave. It's located in Frederick County, just south of Winchester, which is just a tad off of this map that we're looking at. And in 1765, a German immigrant, Adam Kern, purchased 3.5 acres and opened a blacksmith shop near the Hogue's Ordinary. Sometime around 1799 to 1801, there's not a lot of definite understanding of the date, Kern donated most of his land to the Opeckin Presbyterian Church. And it's very possible that the grateful congregation are the ones who changed the village name to Kernstown. It's also thought that actually his son, Adam Jr., was the source of it. By whatever means it happened, by the early 19th century, this little area just south of Winchester was called Kernstown. And like many locales, very similar locales along the Valley Turnpike, Kernstown would see peaceful ways of commerce and farming torn apart by the passage and clashes of armies from 1861 to 1865. This is the church. I thought it had come up, but it was running a little slow there. So Opeckin Church, as it looks today, there have been several sanctuaries on that site. And this is a real mother church of the Presbyterian churches in the Shenandoah Valley. And there's, I apologize for the quality of the image, but that is a few pictures that are close to the time period of the Civil War of the Valley Turnpike, showing that macadamized, crushed stone surface that made it such a useful highway for both commerce and for the armies, particularly Jackson's, that would march across it. Thank you. That's going to help there a bit. I'm good. In spring of 1862, the military situation in Virginia was in a state of flux. Following the Union defeat at First Manassas the previous July, the Union Army of the Potomac was reorganized by Major General George B. McClellan. The dashing young general had been a standout cadet in the fabled West Point class of 1846, called the class that stars fell on for all the members who would become Civil War generals, including one Thomas Jonathan Jackson. While McClellan did a superb job of creating an army, it remained to be seen whether he could actually bring himself to use it effectively. Now, when Jackson was asked his opinion of McClellan at the time, his classmate, he said, if he can handle his troops in the field with the same ability with which he organizes them in camp, he will be simply invincible. And at this time, no one yet knows if McClellan can do that, but he's certainly been under mounting pressure to do something. because as the weather became favorable for campaigning, speculation on what McClellan would do dominated Confederate strategy. General Joseph E. Johnston was in overall command in Virginia, with the bulk of his army positioned around Manassas Junction in Centerville, in northern Virginia. A cautious soldier, Johnston, planned to fall back towards Richmond in response to the expected land assault on Manassas by McClellan. It was expected that any day, as the roads were drying out and the weather was starting to get better in that early spring of 1862. Jackson's roughly 3,500, 4,000-man Valley Army, really a division at this point, not even a full separate army, was subject to Johnston's orders. And he was expected to move southeast to link up with the main body to help defend Richmond when the expected attack would finally come. Now, such a move was contrary to Jackson's aggressive nature and to that of General Robert E. Lee, who at this point was not enjoying a field command, but was in fact the military advisor to Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Despite his innate caution, McClellan finally responded to mounting pressure from Abraham Lincoln and from the U.S. Congress to begin the drive on Richmond. Rather than risk a frontal assault on the Confederate defensive works at Manassas, McClellan planned to transport his 120,000-man army by water to Fortress Monroe, at the opening there of Hampton Roads, and to attack up the peninsula, as we call in Virginia simply the peninsula. We're not terribly creative. We have a street in Richmond called the Boulevard. We have the peninsula. And we just got tired of coming up with names for our land features. I've heard that. Yes, exactly. That's right. Well, Johnston initially disrupted this whole plan of McClellan's by evacuating Manassas and Centerville on March 9th. And when the Union force occupied the area, they discovered painted log Quaker guns that were left behind in the fortifications and the earthworks, and this provoked a considerable amount of ridicule of McClellan's caution in the northern press. Being stung by this, he finally began his movement to the Hampton Roads area on March 17th. Now, why are we talking about McClellan and Richmond and Hampton Roads and all this stuff when we're supposed to be talking about Battle of Kernstown? I'm glad you asked. Even as he took his formidable host south, McClellan labored under the fear that he would be outnumbered. He was also at odds with Lincoln over the defense of Washington, D.C. Now, for much of the war, one of Lincoln's chief concerns would be that the capital might be attacked while the bulk of the Union Army was fighting elsewhere. It was not an unreasonable fear, particularly given the geography of the Shenandoah Valley, which has been described basically as a gun aimed right at the federal capital. Confederate Army moving down the valley, we all know our valley geography, you're going north if you're going down the valley, would be aimed right toward the D.C. area, while a federal army trying to go up the valley into Confederate territory is getting farther and farther away from its base. So the valley's strategic threat to Washington is very real. Now, despite the fact that there were something like 70,000 troops manning this extensive series of fortifications around Washington, Fort Ward being one of the ones that's the most visible example of what they would have been like in that period. Despite all this, Lincoln held back some 50,000 men from McClellan's expedition down to Hampton Roads as a precaution, and he would be particularly sensitive to any perceived threat to Washington, D.C., and put McClellan on notice that his plans for the investment of Richmond would have to include provision for keeping Washington safe. Lincoln's definition of what that meant and McClellan's definition would turn out to be somewhat different as the campaigns were unfolding. Now, back in the valley at his headquarters in Winchester, Jackson's initial impression that the city was indefensible had changed somewhat. He had early on felt that the geography and the layout of Winchester made it a particularly difficult city to defend. Considering the fact that it changed hands during the war something like 72, 78 times, he probably had a point. But as the spring was wearing on, he started to form a somewhat different opinion, and I think that it's at least in part motivated by his desire to preserve some degree of independence of action from Johnston's plans. He wrote to General Johnston on March 8th, "I greatly desire to hold this place so far as may be consistent with your views and plans, and in making arrangements by constructing works, etc., to make a stand. Though you desired me some time since to fall back in the event of yourself And General Hill's doing so, that's General Daniel Harvey Hill, Jackson's brother-in-law, who's somewhat east in the Loudoun area. Even though you desired me to fall back in the event of yourself and General Hill's doing so, yet in your letter of the 5th instant you say, quote, delay the enemy as long as you can, unquote. And that's going to be the key to what Jackson's role initially is in the valley as this threat is evolving from McClellan. Delay the enemy in the valley. Keep those troops in the Shenandoah Valley, those federal troops that are there, from being able to take part in what McClellan's going to do. That's the first goal here, is tie up those troops, keep them from moving east. Jackson's further appeal to Johnston for reinforcements was not fulfilled. So on March 11th, despite what he just said in the letter, 6 days before McClellan started for the peninsula, Stonewall Jackson retired south along the Valley Turnpike from Winchester to Mount Jackson, coming down closer to my neck of the woods in Shenandoah County. Johnston agreed, though, to keep Jackson in the valley, ordering him to approach and observe the Federals that would be moving in, and Jackson was to do everything possible to prevent Union troops from going east to aid McClellan. But he was also to avoid being drawn into battle against a superior force. So it's sort of an observational role, observe and report sort of a role, maybe make a demonstration, but don't get yourself on the wrong end of a fight. It's very important advice order to remember in terms of what happened at Kernstown. As soon as Jackson left Winchester, the 5th Corps of the Union's Army of the Potomac, commanded by Major General Nathaniel P. Banks, shown here, occupied the city. Banks, a career politician, member of the House of Representatives, Speaker of the House, the greatest thing he ever aspired to be, Speaker of the House, and yet a political general of the first kind in the Civil War. He had virtually no military experience at all, but he cut a pretty good figure there early in the war, and that was good enough at this point. He's in command of the troops that are moving into Winchester, but he was ordered to divide his force because, again, Lincoln's got this concern about what's going on further east. And so of the two divisions he has, one of them is going to be sent out of the valley to link up with another Union contingent led by Major General Irvin McDowell near Fredericksburg. McDowell, who had been in command of the Union Army defeated at the First Battle of Manassas back in July of 1861. So one division of Banks' troops going off to Fredericksburg to be with McDowell. And that's part of that force that is supposed to be held to guard Washington. McClellan thinks it can guard Washington from 50, 60 miles away. Lincoln, not so sure. So that's part of the debate going on between them. The remaining division Banks has is commanded by Brigadier General James Shields, a former United States Senator and Mexican War veteran who once challenged Abraham Lincoln to a duel. Has nothing to do with this talk, but it was just a great statistic or a great fact I thought I would share. In fact, they actually got to the field where they were going to fight, and their seconds intervened and called off the whatever that was that precipitated it. They actually became very good friends after that. They were both Whig politicians, but you know, he was ready to stand up to Lincoln. Shields, though, would not be leading his troops as this Battle of Kernstown would unfold, because on March 22nd, as Valley Cavalry under Brigadier General Turner Ashby is coming into the, Colonel at this point, Turner Ashby, is coming into the scene. Shields is going to be wounded, actually organizing a reaction of some of his men to Ashby's move. And so he's out of the picture for a while. He's wounded enough to be taken out of commission. And command will devolve to Colonel Nathan Kimball, who is the commander of General Shields' 1st Brigade. Battle of Kernstown will be Kimball's fight to win or to lose. Got a good party going on over there. Turner Ashby, celebrated as the Black Knight of the Valley or the Dark Knight of the Valley, was a strong-willed leader who managed his unruly cavalrymen with a minimum of military discipline, much to Stonewall Jackson's annoyance. It was Ashby's reconnaissance of Winchester, coupled with information from a citizen spy network in the town, that convinced Jackson that Winchester was essentially devoid of Union troops. And as he noted, writing later about the action during this time, having followed the enemy in his hasty retreat from Strasburg on Saturday evening, I came upon the forces remaining in Winchester within a mile of that place and became satisfied that he had but four regiments and learned that they had orders to march in the direction of Harper's Ferry. This is the conclusion that Ashby reaches, and he's feeding this information to Jackson. At the same time, Jackson has some spies which seem to be telling him the same thing. Not too many Yankees up here in Winchester, so you should be able to handle any of them that are there. Remember, Jackson has this observe and report role. Find out what's going on, but don't let yourself get drawn into a tough fight. Now, taking a pause for the sequence of the fighting for a moment, I want to get a little bit toward Jackson's state of mind at this point. Thomas Jonathan Jackson, a man very much governed by regulation of his character and of his senses and of his both physical and mental condition. He imposed a very strict discipline on himself, but he was capable also of considerable stubbornness, sometimes of extreme reactions in situations. And as he's turning to this task of trying to shadow Shields' divisions, he's still dealing with the aftermath of an internal controversy over the performance of Brigadier General William Wing Loring during the occupation of Romney, Virginia, which is now West Virginia, during the previous winter. This was the winter campaign that Jackson had done in western Virginia in very difficult country, high mountainous areas, what's now Hampshire County, West Virginia, that kind of an area, high view, Cape and Ridge up on the really high country up there, miserable conditions for most of the fighting in that winter of 61-62. And Loring's men were posted to Romney, which was an isolated place, was not well supplied, and he had complained. His men had complained, he had complained, and they even circulated a petition about the conditions there and had bypassed Jackson and gotten it up into the chain of the Army command. Well, Jackson, very calmly but very resolutely, tendered his resignation, said if he could not enjoy the confidence of the government, if he could not control the men under his command, including a general like Loring, then he wanted to be posted back to VMI, back to the faculty of VMI. That was refused. That was turned down. He was convinced that he should stay in his command. So then he brought charges of insubordination against Loring. Now, Loring was a capable officer. He was a dedicated, experienced soldier. So was Jackson. The Confederate government, President Jefferson Davis, had no desire to lose the services of either of them. So this whole mess was eventually resolved with Loring's promotion to Major General and transfer to southwestern Virginia. Just get him out of the picture. Jackson remained in command in the valley, just out of sight, out of mind. Maybe it won't be a big deal. But among other results, this Loring affair, coming just a couple of months before Kernstown would occur, may have hardened Jackson's resolve to exercise a really tight control over his subordinates, both in camp and on the field. And it's going to make him even less tolerant of what he would perceive as failure to execute responsibilities, failure to communicate with him, to follow orders, or to carry out your job. And that's going to be significant for something that happens in the Battle of Kernstown. Now, one more little thing, and this is actually an aside going forward. Loring's military reputation was not seriously hurt in the long run by this brouhaha with Jackson or others that he had with Robert E. Lee or with John Pemberton down at Vicksburg, because in the 1870s, William Wing Loring joined about 50 other Union and Confederate officers who served in the Army of the Khedive of Egypt. Got to wear a fez and a big old uniform there and looking pretty cool. I think he lost an arm, too, as I recall, or part of it. You can see there's something missing in that sleeve. So he was okay in the long run. Back to Kernstown. There are five fairly distinct phases to this battle, this first battle of Kernstown on March 23rd, 1862. The day dawned cool. Cloudy. Temperature was about 40 degrees in the morning. It wouldn't get much above about 55 or so during the day, and would stay overcast for most of the day. Colonel Kimball, who, as we said, has become the commander by default with the wounding of General Shields, is moving against the advance that Turner Ashby had made down the Valley Pike the previous day north of the village of Kernstown. I'm going to try and see if I can highlight this a little bit here. I can get the mouse to give me a pointer. Here we go. Here's the Valley Turnpike, Route 11. South is down below us here, and Turner Ashby had pushed a cavalry detachment along the road in the direction of Winchester, right near where the Opecan Presbyterian Church is. He's out ahead of the rest of the main body of Jackson's force. And so Colonel Kimball is going to be moving south, attempting to block that movement. He's got his 1st Brigade, a portion of it at least, of Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania troops. Also deployed was the 2nd Brigade of this division under Colonel Jeremiah Sullivan. More Ohio and Indiana boys, plus some Illinois ones thrown in there for good measure. The Union troops pushed Ashby south along the pike, taking possession of Pritchard's Hill. And again, I'll try if you can probably see it there, but right there. Pritchard's Hill, this is where the Grimm family's farm was. Appropriate name given the fighting going on around it. Ashby formed a defensive line near the Opecan Church, which was later supported by infantry, and he would maintain that position for most of the rest of this battle. I'm sorry, there is Colonel Sullivan. Forgot about him.
Can you answer a question?
Yes, sir.
Is it Kernstown
or Newmarket? Which is it? Kernstown, sir.
Where does
Newmarket doesn't accept it. That's who pays my salary. I'm the director of the Newmarket battlefield. It comes in later. Ashby had in his command, I think, something along the line of about 800 on the rolls. Whether he had them all there and present is another story. The Valley Cavalry was notoriously casual about showing up. I mean, they were great fighters, but when they felt they had something else to do, they'd be doing it. They're all from the area. Some of them might be heading back to their farm to make sure things were okay. So that was a constant bone of contention between Jackson and Ashby, that Jackson never felt Ashby had a proper military discipline on his unit. They were great scouts, they were great fighters, but they were their own men in many ways. As the morning wears on after dawn, an artillery duel begins between guns that Ashby had brought up along the pike and Battery E of the 4th U.S. Artillery, which was posted at the Grimm family's farm on Pritchard's Hill. This is the Pritchard House. It is extant on the battlefield. It's in need and will be getting over time more restoration, renovation. But the other picture down below here is a view roughly of what the federal artillery on Pritchard's Hill were seeing as they were firing from that hill out across the open plain on the Confederate position. By 11 a.m., as Jackson's infantry began to concentrate south of Kernstown, moving in behind Ashby, Colonel Kimball consolidated his position and awaited his own reinforcements to come onto the field. In the second phase of this battle, at around 2 p.m., Jackson launched a feint or a diversionary movement toward the main position of Colonel Kimball along the Valley Pike with a portion of Colonel Jesse S. Burks's brigade. And it's Burks's, B-U-R-K-S is his name, and so I'm trying to say Burks's and I'm having a little trouble there. Jackson's main push, though, was a flanking march to his left called Sand or Sandy Ridge, which here again you can see right over here. Now, that's important for y'all to know because that's where you're going to be going. This attack is being made by two units, the Stonewall Brigade, Jackson's original command that he started the war with under Richard Garnett, Brigadier General Richard Garnett, and then another brigade led by Colonel Samuel V. Fulkerson. And these men are all Virginians, and they're going to be going over to the Glass family's farm, which was known as Rose Hill, a place where you'll be seeing where some of the worst of the fighting was during the Battle of Kernstown. Confederate artillery on Sand Ridge engaged Union guns on Pritchard's Hill, and a really heavy artillery duels going on for most of this battle from those two high points, while Fulkerson seized an east-west stone fence on the Glass family's farm. And here you can see what some of the current look of the remnants of that fence is. Some portions of it have been rebuilt, and it is the key point to the battlefield on the left, the Confederate left, the Union right. It's the key defensive point that the Confederates occupy for most of this battle. Now, General Garnett with the Stonewall Brigade comes up on Fulkerson's right, and he extends the line from the Occoquan across the ridge, bending south to cover the artillery. And his goal here is to try and make as long and strong a Confederate line as he can. But he doesn't have the benefit of that fence. And that's going to be a factor here a little later. Fulkerson's men are behind the fence. A regiment was deployed along the middle road. I'll show that on the map in a second. To make contact between the two Confederate flanks, the Valley Pike end and over at Rose Hill. Now, responding to this threat, Colonel Kimball sees that he's now got a sizable number of Confederates on his right flank on that high ground over at Rose Hill. So he sends in the fellow whose picture I just brought up here, Colonel Erastus B. Tyler. Nobody names their children Erastus anymore. It's a great name. Too late, I've already named my children. But Erastus Tyler is sent forward to confront Fulkerson and Garnett. And he's going to take the 3rd Brigade of Shields' division that Kimball is commanding over to that side, to the Union right. And as this artillery duel is still going on and these skirmishers are moving forward, making the initial contact with the troops on the other side, the fighting really begins to intensify. Now, middle road that I mentioned is this road right over here, somewhat paralleling, but more to the west, the Valley Turnpike. The 3rd phase now of the Battle of Kernstown begins at roughly 4 p.m. when Tyler deploys his 5 regiments, Erastus Tyler's 5 regiments of about 3,000 men against the Confederates and their position on Sand Ridge or Sandy Ridge, supported by the artillery on Pritchard's Hill. They've also got a small cavalry force accompanying the Union troops. They're going to make this attack on this Confederate position. Now, this is roughly today what that position that the Confederates had on the Rose Hill property looked like. It's not as clear in terms of the sight lines as it would have been in 1862. It's much more wooded throughout most of that land now than you would have seen at the time when this battle was fought. But now these 3,000 Union troops that Colonel Tyler is leading are hitting the Confederate left flank. And there were several attacks that were attempted on this high ground that the Confederates occupied. They were all repulsed. So now Tyler shifts his attack to the center at the crest of this ridge. He's going to try, if he can't break in on a flank, he's going to try going right at the Confederate center. And by this time, Colonel Kimball, in overall command of these Union troops, realizes that Ashby, over on the Valley Pike, this is just a feint. He's nothing to really be worried about. So he's going to commit the rest of his brigade and Colonel Sullivan's brigade, the other 2 brigades of the division, another basically 3,000 men, to the right, combining with Tyler to assault the Confederate right and center. So now the weight of the Union attack is all going to hit on the Confederate line on the right and the center. Whereas Jackson had assumed since dawn that his 3,000 troops were facing a smaller Union force, the growing tempo of the fire now suggests that maybe something's really wrong here. He sends an aide, Sandy Pendleton, up to the firing line to assess the situation. Pendleton returned in a hurry, reporting that rather than only 4 regiments being on the field, the Union force had at least triple that number, and all of them were moving into action. And in probably one of the most unguarded and candid moments he ever had in his life, Stonewall Jackson, and I assume he said this sort of quietly to Pendleton, said, "Say nothing about it, but we are in for it." Very modern-sounding term, I think. Richard Garnett with the Stonewall Brigade, the outnumbered Stonewall Brigade, lacked the protection, as I'd said, of that stone fence that Fulkerson had. And fearing that he was running out of ammunition, fearing he could be flanked, fearing that he simply was facing too many troops, Garnett orders a retirement, a withdrawal from his position. Now, this is all happening in a fairly brief span of time where Garnett is starting to worry that, you know, there are a lot more troops on the field than we thought. We're in a bad position. I need to pull back. Not necessarily to leave the field, not necessarily to stop fighting at all, simply to consolidate and figure out what we need to do. At the same time, Jackson is trying to find a way to reinforce that position. He sent a couple of more, the last 2 regiments of the Stonewall Brigade, up to try and support Garnett, but they don't get there in time, because Garnett has already pulled back the Stonewall Brigade, and Fulkerson's men, seeing that, seeing their flank starting to get uncovered and fire coming into them, they decide they've got to pull back too. So that one action by Garnett, which in his mind was perfectly justified, is in a sense the trigger to a general withdrawal on the Confederate line. Unfortunately, the retreat soon became pretty badly disorganized. The Confederate artillery was still doing its job. It was up there on Sand Ridge. It kept firing on the artillery, both on Pritchard's Hill and also firing on the open ground east of their position, keeping the Union forces that were approaching at bay. But no fire could be brought to bear along the wooded ridge itself. Part of the approach the Union troops had was protected enough that they could make their way forward and threaten this Confederate line. So the Union advance along the crest of Sand Ridge began to have the effect of forcing the artillery to retire. And that's really all that's keeping Jackson's army safe at this point is the artillery. We now reach the fourth phase of this battle, which has now become a rearguard action to try and get the Confederate army off the field in one piece. And it began as Jackson deployed two regiments, the 5th and 42nd Virginia, across Sand Ridge to slow the Union advance. He knows now he's dealing with a retreat. He didn't want to be dealing with a retreat, but Garnett's action has forced his hand in having to not continue the fight, but to pull his army back. And there are several regiment-sized attacks that are going on with the 5th and the 42nd Virginia against the Union troops pressing them, and they get pretty severe. They become hand-to-hand. In fact, it's recorded that the colors, the flag of the 5th Ohio Infantry Regiment, changed hands six times during this fighting. Captured, recaptured, six times. Union cavalry under Colonel Thornton F. Broadhead, another wonderful name out of this battle, advanced along the Jones Road, but they were checked by Confederate horsemen led by Colonel Oliver Funston. I don't have a picture of Funston, so I just threw this in. Darkness ended the fighting now. As darkness comes on, things pretty well settle down. And in the final phase of this battle, Jackson withdrew along Stone Lane past the McGill House, which I could not get a map that located the McGill House, but it's south along the Valley Turnpike, in a sense going back the way he had come. Not all that far. With the darkness, he didn't need to go but so far because the Union pursuit was not coming. He took his forces, the infantry, down to what was then called Newtown, what's now called Stephen City, just a bit south of Kernstown area. The cavalry under Ashby went over to Bartonsville, which is a few miles south of Kernstown and west of the Pike. So within just a few miles of where the fight had gone on, the Confederate force retires, but they can do so fairly safely. Jackson falls immediately to sleep up against a fence, and the man could fall asleep anywhere. And with all that's going on during the day, he just checks out for a while. As I say, the Union forces did not attempt to pursue at this point. Kernstown was a brief but a very costly battle for both sides. Jackson lost 20% of his division, over 700 killed, wounded, and captured. Colonel Kimball's killed and wounded exceeded Jackson's, 570 to 400, but very few Union soldiers were captured, compared to the somewhat like 250 Confederates that were rounded up by the Northern cavalry. Jackson was furious at Garnett's withdrawal of the Stonewall Brigade, which triggered the general Confederate retreat. Remember, he's coming off of this episode with General Loring, and he is finding that his intelligence has been bad before this battle. He's had problems with his subordinates. He's had problems with people following his orders, and now this situation has occurred. Despite the incorrect intelligence that led him to believe he had an advantage in numbers, despite the fact that Jackson's own forced marches, bringing his troops up to Kernstown, had fatigued his men greatly before they were put into battle, Stonewall's after-action report fixated on what he saw as Garnett's disobedience and even his incompetence at Kernstown. And to quote from that report, "Though our troops were fighting under great disadvantages, I regret that General Garnett should have given the order to fall back, as otherwise the enemy's advance would have at least been retarded, and the remaining part of my infantry reserve had had a better opportunity for coming up and taking part in the engagement if the enemy continued to press forward." So it's all Garnett's fault. Garnett's the reason everything went sour here. Now, time and the subsequent reaction to Kernstown of Lincoln and of the Union High Command moderated Jackson's opinion a little bit about the result. Writing several days after his initial report, Jackson stated, "I am well satisfied with the result. Time has shown that while the field is in possession of the enemy, the most essential fruits of the battle are ours." Those essential fruits included the further diversion of troops from McClellan's offensive against Richmond to deal with the situation in the Shenandoah Valley. Now, whether, as many historians tend to like to argue, you regard Kernstown as the last battle before Stonewall Jackson's Valley Campaign, or the first battle of it, events moved forward pretty rapidly afterward. Apparently, retreating south after Kernstown, Jackson instead moved rapidly against the isolating Union forces that had been sent out into the valley before they could combine against him. He would go on to win a victory at McDowell on May 8th and then march over 100 miles north to win the battles of Front Royal on May 23rd and 1st Winchester on May 25th. By June 8th, his army was encamped at Port Republic east of Harrisonburg. Two federal armies under Major Generals John C. Fremont and James Shields, back in action now, were marching to trap him in a pincer movement at the point where the north and south forks of the Shenandoah River come together. Dividing his force, Jackson ordered Major General Richard Ewell to delay Fremont so that Jackson could defeat Shields. So they got to have a fight after all in the long run here. Ewell accomplished his mission at the Battle of Cross Keys on June 8th. Fremont was repulsed, and believing he was facing the entire Valley Army, he drew back to await Shields. Keep in mind, Jackson's been reinforced by now. He's got something like 17,000 men, but he's still outnumbered 4-1. So it's great audacity he's showing in these months after Kernstown to keep these Union armies off balance. The next day after Cross Keys, with his army recombined on the other side of the river bridges and those bridges burned, Jackson scored the last victory of the Valley Campaign against Shields at Port Republic. So in a whirlwind campaign of the next couple of months following this defeat at Kernstown, Jackson completely fulfills his charge of keeping the Union soldiers in the valley and away from McClellan's offensive. Now, as the Union forces in the valley withdrew north, once Jackson had managed to defeat them at battle after battle, Jackson himself brought his army down the Virginia Central Railroad, which is the, well, you can't see that little line, can you? That purple line in the middle, the Virginia Central Railroad coming out of Stanton, takes him right to Richmond. He brought his army to join the other Confederate forces defending Richmond. Just days before, the Confederate commander, Johnston, had been wounded. And as Johnston himself noted, "The shot that struck me down is the very best that has been fired for the Southern cause yet, as it resulted in Robert E. Lee taking command of what he soon christened the Army of Northern Virginia, an indication of where he expected to operate." In the series of battles known collectively as the 7 Days, the Army of Northern Virginia attacked the Army of the Potomac repeatedly, with Lee always seeking a knockout blow to compel McClellan to abandon his quest for Richmond. However, almost every battle was a tactical loss for the Confederacy. Jackson, in particular, exhausted, lethargic from the Valley Campaign, failed to move with the aggressive speed for which he was known before and for which he would be known later. Despite losing most of the 7 Days battles, Lee's unrelenting attacks convinced McClellan, as he already didn't need convincing, he was outnumbered and in danger of destruction. And so he embarked his troops on their transports and began a return to Washington, where he was relieved of command for the first of what would be 2 times. With Richmond thus saved, Lee would take the Army of Northern Virginia to its namesake region to deal with another army being cobbled together by the Union High Command. Now, all that lay in the future beyond Kernstown, but I thought I'd give you a little bit of the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey, the late Paul Harvey, would say, to kind of show what happened in the aftermath. Among the principal figures at Kernstown, Kimball, Tyler, Banks, and Shields, shown here, not in order, though. It's Kimball, Tyler, Shields, and Banks, actually, as I just saw that, would all face Jackson again in battle, and all of them would survive the war. But Mars was not so kind to Ashby and to Garnett, to Fulkerson and Pendleton, all of whom would fall in battle before the Civil War ended. For Lee and Jackson, ahead for them lay Second Manassas and Antietam and Fredericksburg and finally, shown here, Chancellorsville, which for Stonewall Jackson would mean death and immortality. Thank you very much. There it is. Okay.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.